body, and supercharge your health at the new AlkaVision.com.
Gold is like nothing else on earth, from the Romans through the Renaissance.
Webcam microphone.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a.
But I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
Stuff on the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
how
did
that
guy
rise up and bust the brain? You know, or
the
lab of choice, and on the internet, professional
wrestlers,
and not just
Jesse
Ventura style.
It doesn't matter whether it's
cartoon, as long as it's real.
It doesn't
take hard to get real with these fictions.
Because seriously,
and then she
has
raised
her voice
whenever I try to prove out.
No,
it's not.
You expect your government to tell you the truth, you're going to sadly disappoint another one of these things.
Dear Lord, what a dirty old man.
Really now?
Series.
Is this
really
want things to be
more hooker, you know, eruptions,
eruptions,
whatever. Really?
Allegedly broadcast live from FEMA Region 2. Within the borders of the formerly united and currently occupied states of America, we bring you the Originally Effect.
Like, damn sure, no, I'm an original.
We have all these situations. I'd love to know why it takes 50 minutes.
All right. So all that noise lets you know out there that it is time for my show. Of course, this is Chuck Ocelli, the host of the Ocelli Effect. Tonight I have a very special guest, one of the few guys that I have to say among the sea of authors who have touched upon the JFK subject, one of the guys that I consider part of the essential reading. Not only that, but Mr. Morley, Jefferson Morley, who is my guest tonight, is also a journalist, accomplished in many, many ways. And I've got to tell you that personally, I was simply impressed by him first 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago now, at a conference in Pittsburgh, which was really interesting, which was held at the Duquesne University campus. Generally, it's referred to in research circles as one of the WECT conferences. It was for the 40th anniversary. They did that again this year for the 50th anniversary and have actually done some very interesting conferences in between. And if you want to see a master list of individuals that do some real solid work on the JFK assassination and many related subjects, you would want to refer to that. But as I said tonight, Jefferson Morley, who is, again, just one of my favorite guys. He's the author of the book Our Man in Mexico, and also is involved in many, many other ways, and I'm going to let him speak for himself tonight. And hopefully you guys will join in with me also. All right, Mr. Morley, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chuck, and glad to be here. Looking forward to the discussion.
Wonderful. So tonight we're... Definitely, you know, this has been sort of a series for me with trying to get people familiar with some of the people's visions that I value as far as, you know, it comes to the modern history, the contemporary American history that has not really been fairly written in most of the mainstream media. And often individuals in my position are critics of the mainstream media, but you're one of the few guys who has participated in what would clearly be mainstream media, who has actually had a really valid perspective and has done some real work and some really incredible stuff. And I'm really looking forward to hearing about that tonight, especially because when I became interested in the House Select Committee, which was the second governmental body of public significance anyway, to really become involved as far as disseminating information regarding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which also focused on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in the mid-70s, putting out its report in 1979. I found it extremely interesting that there was an individual who was involved in that, and you actually have tried to find out some very serious things about that guy, and this is what one of the first things I want to touch upon with you tonight.
Yeah, well, thanks for that introduction, Chuck. I come to this. I've learned as I've worked on the JFK issue, which is a historical event of huge importance in American history, but it's something that happened a long time ago, and so people don't know about, or it's not in their direct experience. But the continuing relevance of the JFK story for what's going on today, that really impresses me all the time. And I think when you talk about me as somebody who has mainstream media experience, but also a perspective that you like, that's because I'm coming at this trying to say, what if we got this, all this secrecy stuff out of the way? What would our history look like? You know, we hear a lot of reasons why things can't be made public, because the NSA needs to, surveil and stop the, people from attacking America. We hear a lot of explanations like that. But what if we took all that secrecy away around the Kennedy assassination, for example? What would we see? And I think that's what I've kind of been driving at in my journalism and in my website around this is, I'm not invested in a theory. I've been writing about the JFK story for 30 years. I've never written a theory because I don't have one. What I think is we need to get rid of all the secrecy. And then once we get rid of all the secrecy and have all the maximum amount of information possible, then, that's the only way to sort it out, and so that's what I've been trying to do. You make reference to my lawsuit. So just by way of background, in 2003, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request for a CIA officer who was involved in the events of 1963, named George Ioannidis, and, sought all of his records. I thought he was very interesting, not because he was a high-ranking person who plotted to kill the president, which he wasn't, but rather he was a CIA officer who was very deeply involved in these events in 1963, and yet there was no trace of his story in the public record, and the various investigations had never touched on what he had done as when he was working in the Miami station in 1963. So I filed that lawsuit hoping to find out more information, and was, I ran into the iron curtain of secrecy that still surrounds certain aspects of the Kennedy assassination, incredibly enough. So
right. And just to back up a little bit, we're talking about the J.M. Wade station, which was, at least to my knowledge, the largest domestic CIA station in the country.
Yeah, thanks for noting that, Chuck. Yeah, it's very important to understand the context of the times. At that time, Cuba was a very big issue in U.S. domestic politics, and President Kennedy was under a lot of pressure to take action against Cuba because it had a communist government. And as part of that, the CIA was waging a secret war on the government of Cuba. Wasn't so secret in South Florida, where the Wave Station employed, hundreds of people and thousands of agents in seeking to foment a rebellion against Fidel Castro. So, the important thing to understand there is that the CIA was very active in a huge way in Miami.
This is post Bay of Pigs, and Cuba was a huge issue as far as foreign policy went for the previous administration, for certain, and also for the Kennedy administration. So a lot of these programs have taken place with the CIA and even other agencies involved that had a large focus on this because of the so-called communist threat that was on this little island that was so close to our back door, basically. So in conjunction with that, you had a large Cuban population in Florida, which coexisted with this this J.M. Wade station, which was a huge complex for the CIA at the time, right?
Yes. So you have this growing population of Cubans who are leaving the island, because Castro is consolidating his power and creating a one-party system where, you know, if you weren't with Castro's party, you had to leave. So people fled to Miami, and the U.S. had a policy of what we now call regime change. And so the idea was the U.S. was going to overthrow the government of Castro. And this is really the essential background for anybody who's trying to understand the assassination of President Kennedy. It takes the assassination of the president took place in the struggle for power in Cuba. And I think that's very important to remember at all times. We hear a lot of, you know, attempts to explain the assassination and all that, but the main, all those must begin with the understanding of where the context of the assassination, and it was it took place amid the struggle for power in Cuba.
Right, and the domestic concern at that time involving these so-called anti-Castro Cubans and pro-Castro Cubans and the backing of the agency and all these things that we've heard about over the years, this is where the Ioannidis story becomes relevant, right?
Yes. Well, so what I discovered about Ioannidis was that he was sent to Miami to run what was called the psychological warfare branch of the CIA station there. And just to give a little bit of background about how the CIA is organized, within every CIA station or office in a given city, there were different branches that would handle different functions of what the CIA was doing. And so in South Florida, for example, there was a military operations branch, and that was the office that took care of people launching military operations against Castro. And there was a foreign intelligence branch, and that was for people who were collecting intelligence from inside of Cuba and feeding it back to the United States. So one of the articulated missions of the CIA was to wage psychological warfare on the Castro government, and that was done by means of covert action, operations that were would be mounted by the United States but could be denied by the United States if anybody ever accused them of mounting them. And so this was what Ioannidis was doing in 1963. And to me, what was interesting, especially interesting about him, was that one of his jobs was to run Cuban agents in a Cuban student group that was opposed to Castro, called the Revolutionary Student Directorate. And members of the Revolutionary Student Directorate had a series of encounters with Oswald, Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President Kennedy, in the summer of 1963. So Ioannidis was kind of like, you know, he was close to the story. I mean, we don't know a lot about what he was doing at that time, but he was clearly close to the story. And so I was looking for him as somebody who would know something about these events, might have reported it, might have talked about it, might have participated in operations related to it. In any case, a person of interest. And my lawsuit was aimed at developing some information about him. Now,
knowledge about this, I was just going to say, is evident if people want to look into it. When you see the representations of Oswald being confronted on the street by what they called anti-Castro Cubans, which also led to an interview, which people have heard throughout the years, on a New Orleans station, and a discussion about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which Oswald was then tied to, associated with, etc. That was the literature that he was handing out that day. And there was a guy named Carlos Berenguer who had confronted him in the streets in New Orleans. And what is interesting about Berenguer is also with the Cuban Student Directorate, which you were talking about, is also referred to as the DRE in a lot of places, because in Spanish, I don't remember what the phrase is exactly, but...
Right, it's a Spanish acronym for...
For the Cuban Student Directorate or whatever, but it's in Spanish, so it's DRE. Sorry, I don't have that in front of me. It's just off the top of my head. But just to put that in context, so Oswald had had interactions with these guys, had actually been arrested and, you know, for fighting with them and all that kind of thing. But there was more to it even. And so Joannides, who would have been one of the guys who was a controller for some of these guys, became of interest to you for that reason, right?
Well, you know, what exactly he was doing is something the CIA won't talk about. So I prefer not to speculate about that. But clearly, he was knowledgeable or should have been knowledgeable about these events. He was responsible for reporting on the activities of these people and what was going on. So he was in the thick of it. And what's interesting about it is, you know, the CIA is claiming we couldn't possibly make these records secret because it would compromise U.S. national security today. And, you know, you think about that argument. I mean, Joannides has been dead for more than 20 years. Okay. The events we're talking about took place more than 50 years ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. What we were worried about in Cuba 50 years ago was that they were the instrument of a foreign power, namely the Soviet Union. Okay. Well, so that was 50 years ago. The Soviet Union no longer exists. Joannides and all of his colleagues have been dead for many years, and yet the CIA still comes forward and says this has to be kept secret for reasons of national security. And to me, that's a very paranoid attitude. This information that I'm talking about isn't going to harm national security. No American's going to be endangered by the release of this information. That is truly absurd. You know, this is our story. This is the story that the American people deserve. And, you know, I'm not invested in what the outcome is. You know, if I get the information, people can decide what they think about, you know, what that means for who killed Kennedy. But the point is, we are all entitled to that information. And this is where the JFK story is ancient history, right? I mean, it happened a long time ago, but the contemporary relevance is, you know, there's a congressional committee investigating the CIA today. The Senate Intelligence Committee has done a big report on the torture program instituted by the CIA under President Bush. And they've investigated that, and they want to report their findings. And the CIA is fighting the release of their findings. So what we find is a story that's consistent over time, which is the CIA refusing to be held accountable for its actions. And, you know, if we're going to have a democratic form of government, we need to be able to hold a secretive intelligence agency accountable. And so that's the situation that we're in. The JFK story is just a very striking historical example of the power of the secrecy system that is still in effect today. So that's where my interest comes in, is this is history, but it's quite relevant to what's going on in the current Washington situation.
And the behavior of intelligence, you know, entities in our country is relevant to many, many things. And, you know, these lawsuits that you're talking about, this is under the Freedom of Information Act, which a lot of people shorten and call it a FOIA lawsuit, something like that. And what it is that you're asking for information, again, which they say may be of significance for whatever reason. But if you're talking about operatives who are dead, if you're talking about agents or any sort of employees in one form or another that are already long dead, who are you going to endanger by maintaining this veil of secrecy? That's really what is most interesting to me, is that even though, like you say, this is in a way ancient history, and if there is no serious connection to anything of, you know, sort of a dark circumstance that we would be alarmed by, and there's no one that could be endangered by the revelation that would emerge from that lawsuit, it seems pretty odd to me that they still would hang on to these things.
Yes, and so some people say, well, you know, that's what they do. They're a secretive agency, so they hide things. But what they're hiding won't really tell us anything about JFK. And my response to that argument is, well, you know, show me the money. I mean, you know, if that's true, then when these documents are released, it will tell us nothing new about JFK, and we can all go home and not worry about, you know, JFK's assassination. So that's all the more reason to release the information. That's not, you can't make excuses for saying this information shouldn't be released. If that's your argument, then the argument is all of this stuff should be made public. And so, you know, we've seen the power of these agencies and the powers that they claim and the powers that they conceal by secrecy. And so we really have to be concerned, you know, that about abuses of power and the assassination of a president. I mean, that's the ultimate abuse of power. So we really should have maximum disclosure. We really should have full disclosure around this issue. So that's what I've been pushing for in my lawsuit. And that's what I push for on my website, on jfkfacts.org. You know, JFK Facts, we're not pushing any theory about the assassination. We're pushing new information and getting rid of bad information. You know, there's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of stories about the assassination. There's a lot of confusion. And so we're looking to kind of clarify and identify what's solid information. What are the best discussions? What are the most interesting points? What do we not know? That's the mission of JFK Facts.
I found it interesting during your keynote speech at the Lancer conference this year, where you described the basic mission of the JFK Facts website was to eventually have it made into a singular sort of public document that would be, you know, basically sorted so that we have really what it says, JFK, the facts, you know what I mean? And I really found that to be a fascinating goal and really, really worthwhile. I mean, I thought that when I first heard that you were assembling it. And
yeah, and so I'm working on that, Chuck, now. And let me say, I mean, it's technically complicated, but it's something that we're working on advancing and hoping to bring to the fore and really become a focal point for information in time for the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Warren Commission report, which is going to come next September. Mm-hmm. So this idea of developing a place where we can have a alternative explanation to the Warren Commission report that is sound, factually sound, verifiable, and is explains more to people, is more credible to people than the story that we've been given so far. So that's a big challenge, you know, and that's absolutely not something I can do. That's something a whole lot of people can do. And what we need to do is we need to develop a kind of computer platform where people can come together and contribute. So I'm working on that, and people should stay tuned to JFK Facts because we'll be talking more about that, you know, in the coming weeks and months.
Right, and just my opinion now, this isn't you or anything, but my opinion is that it would be really, really worthwhile and quite noteworthy if we could have a very solid sort of consensus document that was put together by the people who have cared about this and worked on this for many years that actually contains real solid information and real truthful, or at least forget the word truthful, but how about an honest explanation of the historical reality that occurred there, and a great and wonderful contrast to the Warren Commission documents, and even the HSCA to some degree, quite honestly, you know, less of a limited hangout, but to my opinion, both of them were what I call the limited cover-up or the limited hangout, and to answer that official record with something like this, I think is extremely worthwhile, and I'm very, very happy that you're doing it.
Yeah, so it's going to be a big job, and I'm going to be, you know, I may ask you and other people for, you know, to help and contribute, because it's not something that any one person can do, but that's something that we as a community and, you know, we as, you know, interested citizens, you know, everybody's got something to contribute to this. So I'm looking forward to making that happen this year.
Right, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the results for sure. And, I mean, it's just been interesting to watch it develop. And I advise anybody listening right now to check it out. Even if you don't look at it right now while you're listening to me, definitely go look at jfkfacts.org, I think it is.
Yes.
And, you know, see how it is developing, because it's going to be a very real and honest document, at the very least, when it's completed, in my opinion, anyway. So that's my two cents about that. And, you know, a lot of the guys who have gotten involved in writing about this really did not set out to do so. It's just that certain things revealed themselves to them over time, and they kind of were drawn into it. And I have that sort of sense from you that this wasn't exactly something that you intended on getting into. You know, I did say that Jim Lazar, who is the guy who was representing you in these FOIA lawsuits, because you're not a lawyer, right?
No.
So you're just, you know, but you're an interested party who these suits have been brought on your behalf. But the guy who's actually doing the legal footwork for you is Jim Lazar. I just wanted to mention him as well.
and he's done a fantastic job at tremendous personal sacrifice to himself. We are waiting now for the judge's decision on whether the government has to pay our court costs. And typically, in cases like this, where the plaintiff wins at the appellate level, the government has to pay the court costs. And that's a kind of sensible incentive, right, for the government to present defensible arguments in court, because if they lose, they're going to pay money. And so we took them to court, and we won. We won a unanimous reversal of the dismissal of the case in 2007, and the three-judge panel said the CIA had to go do a whole bunch more searches, and we learned a lot more information as a result of that court decision. And so our argument to the court now is that the government should pay our court costs, and the CIA is fighting that, because they don't want to admit that we got anything of any value in this lawsuit. And that's simply wrong. If you read the stories on jfkfacts.org, you can see that this lawsuit obtained new information about the Kennedy assassination and that there was a real public benefit to that. So, you know, we have made some progress against very difficult odds. The courts, you know, defer to the CIA on right. questions of national security. The judges say, you know, not without reason, you know, we're not the experts in this matter and we need to defer to, you know, the people who are. But I think they err on the side of the secretive government agencies, and they should lean more on the side of there's real public benefit and value to full disclosure. And so I've kept this lawsuit up for 10 years because I think that it's very important that principle be underscored and vindicated. Mm. Full disclosure is a very good idea. I mean, I know the CIA doesn't like it, but it's actually a good idea for the CIA. It's as well as a good idea for the rest of society. We need our full history. And that might embarrass people or cause a scandal at the CIA today. That's not important. The important point is that the people are entitled to their history. And so I think we're going to make that point in the lawsuit. I think we have made that point, and I think it's going to get through.
And as you say, even if scandalous information is revealed or improper action or, you know, the worst of the worst is revealed, at the very least, we could possibly learn how to avoid those types of things from happening again. That's the minimum that could be gained. And the maximum that could be gained is a realistic look at the history of how the CIA may or may not have interacted with some very extremely important events in our history. And
yes.
I think that we deserve ownership of that, and that's why I really respect what it is you're doing. Just so our listeners know, I just want them to know that if they want to join in, the phones are going to be open, and that's at 718-717-8296. If you guys want to join in, I'll be taking calls shortly. You know, and we'll just see how that goes. But meanwhile, I find all this very, very interesting. And I hope you guys are also taking this all in. Okay, now, we talked about Mr. Joannides, who you're trying to find out about. Did you want to add any more detail to that? Or?
No, I think I've laid that out. Well, maybe I could just tell a little bit about what we learned in the course of the lawsuit, because where is this story going?
That would be great. Well, yeah.
So I was interested in Joannides as a representative character of a mid-level CIA officer in a position to know a lot about the events of 1963. So what did he know? What I learned in the course of the lawsuit was a couple of things that are significant. The first was that Joannides maintained a residence in New Orleans during the time that he was stationed in Florida. So he lived in Miami, and he worked out of the CIA station in Miami. But he also had a residence in New Orleans during the time that he was assigned to South Florida. So that means that Joannides may have been living in New Orleans at the same time that Lee Harvey Oswald was living there, and at the same time that his agents among the Cuban exiles had contact with Oswald. And so given all the extreme secrecy that's surrounding Joannides' actions in 1963, to me it's very interesting that he was in the same city as Oswald. I'm not, you know, is that significant? Well, it could be. I mean, we didn't know anything about this guy. No investigators knew anything about this guy. And now it turns out he's running agents who have contact with Oswald, and he himself was living in New Orleans. So that raises the stakes or the question, you know, what did he know? What did he know about Oswald, and when did he know it?
Right.
And the fact that we learned about his New Orleans residence via this litigation, which I did not know when I filed this lawsuit that Joannides had a residence in New Orleans. I thought it was possible, and I was, you know, curious as to whether I would find anything along those lines. And in fact, I did. So that was one thing that we learned from the litigation, and was, you know, something that was very concretely related to the story and is very relevant. A second thing that we learned that I didn't know when I filed the lawsuit was that Joannides got a medal from the CIA, what's called the Career Intelligence Medal. And it's basically the second highest honor that a career CIA officer can get. It's given for a career of exceptional achievement. That's the phrase that they use, exceptional achievement in the agency. So Joannides was, upon retirement, was given a pretty high honor. You know, he had done a lot for the agency in the eyes of the agency. And that signaled that kind of approval of everything that he had done. So in 1963, he had been running these Cuban agents who had contact with Oswald. And then in 1978, he had served as the liaison to the House Select Committee on Assassinations and had, you know, been involved in the second investigation of the assassination. So he was somebody who was very involved in the JFK story.
Right, and let's talk about that just a second. The fact that he was involved with the HSCA is really the clincher for me as to why this is of even greater interest than just the possible Oswald connection, because there's an opportunity for him to have been connected to Oswald. That's an opportunity, but not a solid, necessary conclusion that we could make.
Exactly.
However, one solid conclusion we can make is that when the House Select Committee on Assassinations, okay, which was supposed to reinvestigate the Kennedy assassination, all right, required a liaison with the Central Intelligence Agency, they requested that they get someone who had no ties to the previous investigation and had no ties to the JFK matter so that there wouldn't be a conflict of interest, ostensibly. And what they got was this guy.
Yes, and I mean, to me, this remains the most startling thing I found. And I've never heard a good explanation of it. The people who were involved from the HSCA, when I told them about this, were shocked. I mean, truly shocked. Bob Blakey, who was the general counsel for the HSCA and ran their investigation, was stunned that he had been fooled by Joannides. And in a very profound and brazen way, Dan Hardway, who worked with Joannides, he was one of the House investigators, who was looking for CIA files, looking to interview CIA people, and he dealt with Joannides and felt the brunt of his hostility.
And Dan Hardaway, just for my listeners to understand, when you look at the JFK assassination and you look for references on it, and people bring up something they call the Lopez Report, that was Edwin Lopez was an investigator who, among his duties with the HSCA, was sent down to Mexico City to examine the possible appearance of Lee Harvey Oswald at the Russian and Cuban consulates in October of 1963, okay, which is of great significance and needed to be reinvestigated. And Joannides is directly involved in that as well, isn't he?
Yes. And so, I mean, so somebody who was involved in covert operations in 1963 is responding to the requests of congressional investigators years later to find out about it. And as Blakey said, you know, he was in a position to control what we saw.
So the reasonable conclusion for anybody observing this entire story about his involvement with the HSCA is to think that the agency purposely put him in that place to run interference, because he would be the guy who would be familiar with some of this stuff that they were investigating directly.
It's a perfectly reasonable conclusion. I mean, who knows if it's factually right, but the point is the CIA should clarify it. I mean, if it's true that the president was killed by one man, you know, one disturbed man for no reason, if it's true, there should be no problem in explaining any of this, right?
Right.
I mean,
and
nothing to it.
Right. So, I've always said that when it came to Oswald and the fact that they've also guarded the documents regarding his life, his interactions with government agencies in general, and that's everything from, believe it or not, the U.S. Customs to the CIA, his files, his involvement when he went over to the Soviet Union at one point, all of these different things going on. They have held on to tons of documents regarding Oswald, regarding the CIA, and they've refused to release them. And I've always said that if this was one lone, deranged killer who had his own twisted motives, had no sort of significance when it came to the national security state at the very least, then why is it that we withhold even a single piece of paper?
Right. So this is the problem we face, Chuck, is I think that the position you and I are talking about, when I go talk to people, I mean, it's kind of a common sense position. And what's interesting to me is it's a common sense position across the political spectrum. I can talk to people who, you know, who we would say, you know, they're really on the left, you know, they're kind of liberal, radical, you know, leftist. And then I talk to people who are, you know, very conservative, libertarian, you know, a very different philosophy. And one thing all of these people can agree on is, hey, the government should just make all of this public, you know? And it's really a commonsensical position. The problem is that as you get closer to power in Washington, people have things to lose by full disclosure. You know, full disclosure might result in, you know, a threat to the CIA's budget. It might result in somebody's reputation, you know, taking a hit. And so people have things to lose by full disclosure in Washington, and the secrecy system is very strong. And so you have kind of a common sense position among most people in the public. Hey, let's get to the bottom of this, you know, put it all out there, you know, let the chips fall where they may. And that's kind of, you know, I would say 60, 70, 80% of people, if you ask them about JFK, they'll agree on that, regardless of, you know, liberal, conservative, moderate, or whatever. But the government has the veto power, and so the minority position that, oh, you know, we can't possibly make this public, that's the one that it really has more effect in law. And this is the problem that I confront and that we all confront in thinking about this, is how do we roll back that government ability to check what the people want, you know?
Mm. This is one of the difficulties. And again, it is still relevant because to this day, we are still faced with the same type of problem when it comes to dealing with the NSA, what it is they know, how it is they gather it, and all of these mechanisms. Well, they were born during this time period we're talking about, you know, in the 60s, in the 50s, all of the things that you see today, you know, they were built off of the backs of those situations. And so it is also relevant for that reason, in my opinion, anyway.
No, and I couldn't agree more, Chuck. I mean, that's what's important. You know, the question of who killed JFK. I think we have to say at this point it's a historical question. You know, if there were other people involved, they're dead now. I think we need to have an amnesty and just talk about these things openly. But that's history. What's going on today is, you know, the same system of national security agencies are claiming the same powers of secrecy to hide their actions. And so the people don't have access to our own history. In the case of JFK, that's now ancient history, right? That's now 50 years old. But, you know, what's more important today in today's political situation is, you know, what happened in the last 5 years when the CIA was running a torture program, you know? So we need to know about that as a self-governing republic, you know, we need to know about that, and yet we're blocked from finding out. So the JFK story is relevant because it's the most extreme example of this secrecy system that is still very powerful.
Right, and I think that the reason why the individual needs to care about this stuff, you know, far beyond setting the historical record straight, is again the idea that these things are being done in our name. And whether we are talking about assassinations or torture or the starting or provocation of warfare, this is the type of things that these intelligence agencies have been involved in, provably. And without an idea of how that actually works, quite often it really skews the perspective that you are able to gather from world events in general. And, you know, that's relevant when it comes to the war on terror, when it came to the Cold War, when it came to et cetera, et cetera. This is all relevant. So
yes.
I really, I always have to take a moment to make sure that I explain to people that this is not just about a historical event. This is about today, because these things started from then to get to here.
Yeah, and I think that's a very good way to put it, Chuck, and I've kind of come to my own realization around this point. You know, the assassination of President Kennedy really was a turning point. And it was a time when this secrecy system was able to really establish itself and insulate itself from any scrutiny from the press or from Congress or from the public. And we're still living with the consequences of that. And so while it happened long ago, you know, we still see the consequences today. The specifics are different, you know. But the abuse of power and the issue of accountability is exactly the same. And that's the importance of the moment of these issues in this moment right now.
So also, you know, since we brought up Mexico City, or at least I brought up Mexico City, and we talked about the Lopez report and the investigation of that stuff going on down there. An interesting player in that was Wynn Scott. And I've read some things on him, but I got to tell you, some of the material on him has only really surfaced in the past few years. And, you know, Win Scott, you want to talk about who he was?
Yeah, so Win Scott was a remarkable character. He was one of the founding generation of the CIA. He was not a man, unlike many people in the CIA, he was not a guy who came from a privileged or Ivy League East Coast background. He grew up very poor in the South. He was kind of a self-made man. And yet he rose to a position of considerable power as chief of the CIA's station in Mexico City in the 1960s. And in that job, he had a front row seat on Lee Harvey Oswald's visit to Mexico City shortly before the assassination of President Kennedy. So in my book, Our Man in Mexico, I tell the story of the life and times of Win Scott, who he was, how he came up through the ranks of the CIA, and how he arrived in Mexico City in a position of incredible power in that country. Win Scott was really, after the president of Mexico, Win Scott was probably the second most powerful person in Mexico in the 60s. So a remarkable achievement. So what I tried to do in Our Man in Mexico was I realized early on that I could not use this book to solve the Kennedy assassination, if that's possible. And I realized I didn't want to do that. What I wanted to do was I wanted to tell the story of a man, you know, a very competent and interesting and capable man. I mean, not that I agreed with everything he did. I didn't at all, but I couldn't deny that he had a photographic memory. He was very charismatic. He had an interesting personal life. He was married three times. He wrote poetry in his free time. He was a very sensitive, thoughtful man. He was just an interesting guy all around. And so rather than solve the Kennedy assassination, I wanted to recreate in my book, what did these events look like in his eyes? What did he think had happened in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963? What did he think about Lee Harvey Oswald? I mean, I could go and develop my theory and, you know, we could talk about it and, you know, waste a few hours. But what Win Scott thought, that was really more interesting. I was more interested in what he thought than what I thought, because he was very well respected in the CIA. He had access to all kinds of intelligence. He was very experienced in espionage operations and communist infiltration and all kinds of, you know, real deep espionage work. That was Win Scott's bread and butter. So what did he think of the events that led to President Kennedy's assassination? And I try and tell that story in Our Man in Mexico. And I should say, actually, this would be a good point to mention, the book is coming out as an ebook for the first time this month. It's available from the University Press of Kansas. The publisher, the University Press of Kansas, published the book, the hardcover book, in 2008, and now they've just published the ebook version. So if you read ebooks, you can get it now. And it tells the story of what this man thought at the heart of the JFK story. And to kind of summarize quickly, you know, well, what did he think had happened? I mean, he was, like a lot of people, he was not exactly sure what had happened, but he was pretty sure that the Warren Commission was not right. And he said this, and he wrote this down. It's very clear that he felt that somehow Oswald had been made part of some kind of conspiracy to kill the president. Now, Win Scott never published that book. He died, and the manuscript was seized by the CIA, and it never saw the light of day. But that is what he thought. And if you think about it, that's pretty interesting, because he was way up in the CIA. He had no reason to blame the CIA. He was not a quote-unquote conspiracy theorist. He was one of the best CIA officers of his generation. I mean, he was a man of very solid judgments, you know, according to the U.S. government and according to the CIA.
Right. He was well, A well-trusted, highly intelligent asset who was in control of a very important station as a chief. He also, I've only seen a few pages. I was going to get into that about that unpublished manuscript because I've seen a few pages of it. And I've got to say that any of the impressions interviewing people over the years who had known him, it was very hard to get even information from people who knew him on a tangential sort of level because it was well guarded. And the agency absolutely did not want his manuscript out or really any of the information about him to emerge.
No, not at all. And that's the story that I tell in the book of how the agency suppressed the manuscript. So, you know, that's another, Our Man in Mexico is another instance of getting a little bit closer to the reality of these events as they were understood by the people who were closest to them. And that's, I think, that's where we can really learn something about the past. So,
right, and that's the definition of what I think, in my opinion, is the best journalism possible, is when you can take and provide the perspective of the witnesses to history, and not just the people who saw the actual events, but I mean the witnesses to history as it unfolds in front of them from their particular perspective, their particular perch in life, in their jobs, in their situations. It doesn't matter. The point is that the people that were actually close to the events, the people that were close to the mechanisms that had involvement in the events, these are the people that you can rely upon for a realistic viewpoint because they were there. They understood a lot of things that maybe as, you know, as the public doesn't seem to grasp exactly the nuances of all these, you know, rather interesting things like espionage and how intelligence really works and how the agency functions, the hierarchy of it, exactly where information would have gone, would it not have gone. I mean, the study of just the cables, which, you know, were those teletype cables, which are hard to explain nowadays to people who are so used to the internet and email and things like this. But just watching the cable traffic that occurred between CIA headquarters in Washington and these different stations and watching them exchange information is highly educational, even from a perspective of almost complete ignorance, because they were very, very close to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but.
Well, this is, I mean, my book, Our Man in Mexico, is really an effort to kind of get, you know, get into the nitty gritty of the way the CIA really worked. And so I have a lot about, Wynn Scott's daily communications. A tremendous amount was put onto the public record in the 1990s, and I really benefited when I was writing my book and having access to, you know, thousands of pages of CIA cables and information that had not been made public before. So really came up with a better, clearer understanding than even the investigators, the congressional investigators of the 1970s had. I think that I, you know, kind of moved the story forward in terms of what we now know. And now another writer, my friend Bill Simpich, has kind of advanced the story even a little bit more in his new book, which is called State Secret. And people can download from the Mary Farrell Foundation website, maryfarrell.org. Bill Simpich in State Secret really writes just about Oswald's trip to Mexico City. It's a very focused book on just on that event and what happened. I covered those events in my book, and I thought I told the story in pretty good detail as it appeared in the eyes of Wynn Scott. But what Bill Simpich has done in State Secret is really shown found a lot of records that were not available to me when I wrote my book, but have become public since then. And, you know, there was even more going on than I knew in my book, and he captures some of the detail. But, the long and the short of it is the whole situation with Oswald in Mexico City is, it was very important. It was very sensitive within the U.S. government, and this is before President Kennedy has been killed. So the level of attention around Oswald and who he is and what he's doing is very visible and now documented at the highest levels of the CIA 6 weeks before Kennedy was killed.
And the implications and the misinformation that occurred regarding this are huge, because the fact is that in late September and early October, because the time period is a little bit askew, but the last few days of September and the first few days of October of 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly makes a trip to Mexico City, okay, visits the Cuban and the Soviet consulates, which are, some people say embassy. The embassy and the consulates were actually on the same compound, but that's a whole other story. And the CIA was supposed to be monitoring these places as just a matter of course. Now, they reveal, and you could find this in some other places, they reveal these photographs to, say, the Warren Commission, and even further gave another set of photographs, a greater set of photographs, I believe, to the HSCA of a character that they claim was Oswald, who clearly wasn't Oswald. There is a huge discussion about the fact that he made phone calls, an application for a visa, attempting to get back into the Soviet Union again. At one point, even this entire incident, and you know this is true, that they claim that he even took a gun and placed it on the desk of a Russian consulate worker. And all of this stuff having happened just within that little time period right before the assassination, where the government then claims that this very same man shoots and kills the President of the United States in broad daylight in Dallas, Texas, just by chance.
Right.
You can take and make a lot of things out of that. You can say that it was, you know, sort of a diversionary thing. You could say that it was part of the pre-framing of Oswald. You could say that it was a real thing that happened and this guy was a confused kid. But here's the difficulty, and here's the rub on it all, is that the agency didn't play honest about what happened here to begin with. And this is one of the things that first Eddie Lopez and Dan Hardaway started to reveal to the HSCA, and then his report on that situation was classified for a long time. And those documents, the cables, and a lot of the stuff that you're talking about having become declassified in the mid-90s, only happened as a result of the JFK Records Act, which, again, was something I referenced on another show. I called it the ARRB, and I explained to you guys that that was the Assassination Records Review Board, which was brought about after the public outcry from the Oliver Stone movie. And it, at the end of that movie, there was a little graphic which basically said that many of the records of the House Select Committee were to be sealed until either 2017 or 2029. I think it was 2029 to begin with. And that none of these records were going to be made public until then. This stuff then, after the Assassination Records Review Board was formed, I mean, I'm giving you a very short story on this, was formed and put into place, and they sat and vetted these documents as they existed in various agencies' hands over the short life of that agency under a law which was established under the executive branch, mind you, placed in the National Archives without trying to reinvestigate, but just simply as a matter of placing in the National Archives these documents relating to the assassination into what is now today called the JFK Records Collection, which is at Archives 2 in College Park, Maryland, I believe.
Yeah. So we have, you know, a tremendous, we know a lot more about this period, and and historians, and not just historians of the assassination, but historians of America in the 60s, are indebted really to Oliver Stone for forcing into the public eye all of these records that we probably never would have seen without that. So we've learned a lot about the assassination, and we've learned a lot about America in that period in general from this kind of full disclosure. But as we said before, there's still a lot of secrecy. There's still a lot of secrecy. It's amazing. And I never fail to be amazed when I think about how much the government is still keeping secret. And it's hard to, sometimes it's hard to tell people that because, you know, they think, well, God, you know, how is that possible? They think you're crazy to say it. And it is crazy that this secrecy continues. But, you know, the fact is that it's not crazy to believe it because it's totally true. And so I think we all need to do something about that. And, you know, hopefully something can be done.
And there have been various attempts to free up more records. As of right now, to my knowledge, there are at least 1,100 documents in the CIA's possession. And mind you, these are the 1,100 documents that we know about are in the CIA's possession. And when I say document, again, this doesn't mean a single page, by the way. In some cases, when I've made requests for documents, I've ended up with hundreds of pages for a single document number. Okay, so I'm telling you that of these 1,100 documents, they could be a single sheet of paper, not even completely covered, or they could be something nearly as thick as a phone book.
Yes, okay? No, and I can tell you, Chuck, so among the withheld documents are there's seven files, seven different identified files related to the secret operations of David Phillips. David Phillips was a career CIA officer. He was the deputy to Win Scott in Mexico City. He was a clever covert operator. He was highly regarded among his colleagues. So they retain seven files on him. Seven files have 600 pages of material in them. So when you talk about 1,100 documents are withheld, it's probably more accurate to say 1,100 files are withheld. So if you think about that, in that 1,100, you would say seven of those files relate to this man, David Phillips, and those seven files have 600 pages in them alone. So if you think about how many pages the 1,100 files consist of, we may be talking about a body of a stack of paper that has 15 to 50,000 pages in it. Right. So, you know, this is not a small amount of information. Now, people say, well, you know, is there a smoking gun in there and all that? You know, who knows? I mean, what I can say is 50,000 pages is a lot of pages. And I don't doubt that most of those have nothing to do with JFK's assassination and would not be of importance to anybody. But I would also bet that there are very, very relevant records to the Kennedy's assassination within that. It might only be 10 pages out of 50,000.
And some of these pages, just as a commentary, because I've done some of this research on a deep level, and I've got to tell you that some of this stuff, which appears to be rather innocuous to the public, is very revealing to those of us who have already dug into it. For instance, when you look at the pages sometimes where you see that someone has checked out a file, okay, not necessarily the contents of the file, but you begin to look at who looked at that file, when they had it in their possession, and things like this, it really does change your idea of the significance of that file. In a lot of cases, it makes you take another look at it. I mean, simple things like that where it's just, you know, a list of, it looks like boxes with some initials on it and some dates. These things are of great significance when they're put in their proper context. So the fact that some of it is being withheld is really relevant. And speaking of withholding, I don't know if you wanted to comment any more about the files. And you're right, I should just call them files, not documents. But, you know, Ann Goodpasture, was another name that I really did not know much about until I started to read some of the stuff that you were writing.
Mm-hmm.
So it, your
yeah,
writing
so,
led
so
to it.
So Ann Goodpasture is another good example. Ann Goodpasture was a career CIA officer, and she was kind of the assistant or right-hand man of Win Scott. If Win Scott wanted something done, you know, find a file, find a person, do this, do that, he went right to Ann Goodpasture. And she was very efficient. She was very smart. She knew a tremendous amount about CIA operations at the time. So, you know, she was an important character. And I interviewed her for my book in 2005. She has since passed. She died in 2011. A very interesting character. When we talk about these files that are still withheld, there's a couple hundred pages on Ann Goodpasture that are still secret. So another person who's pretty close to the story. Ann Goodpasture knew about Oswald's visit to Mexico City. She knew about Oswald before President Kennedy was killed. You know, she was a knowledgeable CIA officer. So we still don't know her full story. And, you know, that's the situation that we confront today.
Right. And discussing, you know, Goodpasture and all this stuff about what went on. I mean, this was really revealing to me in that the surveillance that was supposed to be occurring at that time over, you know, at the consulate / embassy compounds of the Soviet Union, which was primarily our boogeyman of the day. Okay, and I know that's kind of a rough term, but really that's what they were. They were the boogeyman of the day, and the closest hand of the boogeyman was supposed to be down in Cuba. This was a major national security concern at that time. And the fact is that they were surveilling their embassies and consulates for stuff like an Lee Harvey Oswald to show up. There was supposedly tapes of conversations where he had made phone calls to the consulates and the embassies, and all of the strange things that occurred with those tapes and those files give you a really interesting look at what the agency was doing when it came to information about Oswald that really, in real terms, if you had proof that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Soviet sympathizer, a Cuban sympathizer, what would that have done? It would have supported the Warren Commission's conclusion that regardless of whether he was truly connected to these governments or these entities or not, he would have had a motive in his own mind to participate in things like the assassination, to do things like this. And if they had photographs of this man, I love that Mark Lane used to say this all the time, that if there was a photograph of this man at the Soviet or Cuban consulates that the CIA could produce, that would have been one of the first things they gave the Warren Commission, and it probably would have been on the inside cover of the first volume. You know, it
yes.
amazes me that when you discuss the type of secrecy that occurred regarding those events, regarding the players, regarding the characters who had the hands-on ability to influence what was being disseminated, not only to the American public, but even to our own government agents and our own representatives who were supposed to be exerting civilian control over a lot of these agencies. This is the kind of thing that we are still combating.
Yes.
And as you said, even to this day, you have the Senate committee, which is investigating, you know, these different intelligence agencies. You have all these revelations coming out about, you know, from Snowden and all this stuff like this. This stuff is still very, very relevant. And I'm telling you, if you learn about the developmental years of any child, okay, the early developmental years, it really does give you an insight into what they develop into later. And if the CIA was a baby back then, it has grown.
Yes.
Okay. And so has the NSA, and so has the entire intelligence community. And I think that without a doubt, this is one of the things that makes this story so extremely, extremely important. And for anybody who wanted to know why it was that I wanted to have Mr. Morley on today, it's because I wanted to show you guys that this is exactly the type of stuff that is alarming people like myself, that these agencies are so far out of control, in my opinion, and in the opinions of almost all of us, you know, that are involved with listening to this network and the type of networks that are out there emerging in the alternative media. This is the real solid reason. This is not conspiracy theory. This is the reality of what has occurred in your history. And all of the holes in that history, unfortunately, are being left to be filled in by, and I'm sorry, Jefferson, to say this about you, but it's unfortunate that it is you that is filling in some of these holes. Because our government should have disclosed this stuff to us from the get. And that's it.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, and so, you know, we don't have that luxury, Chuck. And so I undertook this because, you know, somebody's got to do it. You know, wherever I go, I'm always encouraged by people from all walks of life, all different political opinions, all different incomes. And people say, you know, good work, you know, keep at it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of people, a lot of us who share the same thing. This is kind of a commonsensical position that, you know, full disclosure is a good idea. You know, we can't be afraid of the past. We need to, if people have, you know, made mistakes, if the country's done something wrong or the CIA has done something wrong, you know, the worst thing is to pretend that you don't have a problem. You know, it's painful to pull off the Band-Aid. But it's better when you do it, you know? And so that's really what we need to do in this situation. And I'm encouraged because I think most people agree with this. We've got a problem that the government is so recalcitrant and the CIA is so obstinate. We do have numbers on our side. So that always gives me hope.
You know, me too. And I've got to say that, you know, I can't give enough praise to all the work that I've seen from you. You know, and just as a quick commentary, I don't know if you want to touch on this too much because I didn't do any pre-interview with you or anything. In fact, this is the first time you and I have had any sort of an extensive conversation. I really only know you from, presentations of yours that I've seen and, your participation in some of the conferences and things like that, and some of your writing over time. You know, the first article I ever observed of yours was, I think, in the early 90s, where you wrote about the social significance of the Kennedy assassination, and that was where I first pick up with you, but not even at the time. It wasn't concurrent with the time. More or less, I picked up with you about 2003 when this lawsuit came to my attention. Jim Lazar also writing about it at some points as well. And I've got to say that I really, really do commend you for all this. And I'm so, so glad that there is one guy out there that's, you know, that's involved in the mainstream, because it's so sad quite often that that we have so many mainstream people that are just willing to leave things as they are and continue to toe sort of the party line as far as leaving the history to the history and saying,
right,
look, that's already been concluded. I don't know, like I said, I don't know if you want to take any sort of time to comment on this, but, you know, what has been the reaction from people that you work with and stuff like that, as far as the type of work you've done regarding this?
Well, you know, there's a wide variety of reactions. Like I said, you know, some people, I run into people all the time who encourage me and are supportive and, you know, say good things. I find that happens outside of Washington more than it happens inside of Washington. As you get closer to Washington, this is a more sensitive issue. And so, you know, some people don't have a good reaction to it. They think, oh, you know, why bother? We'll never know. We already know. You know, you hear a lot of different arguments. Over time, I have found more and more people say, you know, you're on the right path. I mean, that they may not agree with me about what I think about what happened or, you know, all of that, but nobody disagrees that full disclosure is a bad idea on this. You know, everybody I talk to, even if they think I'm, you know, slightly, you know, like on the wrong path, they still think, well, fine, you know, we need full disclosure, you know? And so it's, you know, the reaction varies widely. And if people are negative about what I'm doing, you know what? I ignore it. You know, I focus on the positive.
Right. Well, I'm extremely grateful for all the work you've done, I got to say. And it's been most enlightening to me.
Yeah.
You know, this issue, though, I can't stress it enough. It is not going to go away because this is a real snapshot of the early evolution of what it is we are confronting today. And, you know, I don't know how else to say that except.
No, I think that's a very good point, Chuck, is that's the relevance today, is that this was a formative moment, and the structures of secrecy and covert operations and the whole kind of secret world of Washington power really crystallizes and becomes powerful at the time of the Kennedy assassination, or becomes untouchable. And so that's when we really lost accountability. And, you know, and we're living with the consequences of that to this day.
Okay, so just to go back over this one more time, we have the JFK. You want to talk about the website just a little bit more? The JFKfacts.org website?
Yeah, so JFKfacts.org, we post every day timely latest developments in Kennedy assassination research, in debates about secrecy and declassification in a contemporary sense. This is all fair game for the website. Try and bring out new stories. People have new information. We try and prevent a diverse, you know, range of debate because people feel very strongly about the JFK assassination and this aspect of it and that aspect of it. Try and have a strong debate, but also a civil debate, where people can learn something if you don't believe this side or that side and you just are trying to figure out more. We hope that if you come to the site, you'll learn something and you'll be better able to decide for yourself. We're not pushing any point of view on people. We want people to look hard at this important moment and reach their own conclusions. There's no other way to do it. We're not trying to convince you of anything. We're trying to give you our best sense of what's going on.
Right, and then of course you have the book, which is going to now come out as an ebook. Do you know if it's going to be available in all forms, like Kindle and all that, or it's just going to be?
Yes, yes, it will. And people should look. I'll be posting that information on JFK Facts this week about how they can purchase the ebook. So, yes, it will be available in all formats.
Okay, and for now, you know, you can also find it. I know for sure that it can be found in. Lots of places. I mean, the easiest place to find it would be online at Amazon or something like that. And
yes,
I should say,
Chuck, that people can also I have an add-on on JFK Facts. People can order an autographed hard copy from me as well. So if you look on the site, there's a place to send a request to get the signed copy of the hardcover book. So that's also available.
And I'm often asked about what my top books are regarding the Kennedy assassination. And I have two lists, and one of them is a reference list, and one of them is just my favorites list. Mr. Morley is actually on both of them. Okay. So I'm telling you now that the Our Man in Mexico book is extremely enlightening. And even if you're not necessarily focused on the JFK assassination, the insights it provides into the behavior of the CIA and the ideas of disinformation and some of these characters that that we've discussed tonight, as well as, and I have never, ever gotten over the fact that this was the same guy that they used as the liaison with the HSCA. Now, the HSCA had its good points. It was the, I believe it's the only time in history that the United States government has provided us with two separate conclusions to the same investigation, essentially, because the Warren Commission said it was Oswald acting alone. The HSCA still says it was Oswald, but says, well, most likely it was a conspiracy. And a lot of people have tried to speculate that that was only due to this acoustics evidence, which is arguable. And believe me, I'm going to do a program on that later. But the fact is, it wasn't just that. Don't let anybody tell you that it was just this new acoustics evidence that turned it all around. The CIA's complicity in distorting that investigation, this is my opinion now, so I'm not speaking for Mr. Morley, but the CIA's complicity in distorting that investigation, which was supposed to be a revealing investigation for the public, is unquestionable. And the fact that Ioannidis was used as a liaison is proof in my mind that there was no good intention by the intelligence agencies to be forthright about any of their behavior, regardless of whether it was conspiratorial, complicit, you know, in some way or other, what is the word I'm looking for here, you know, if it was just a failure of the agency to act in any way, shape, or form, it doesn't matter. The fact is that, again, a logical and sensible conclusion about putting this guy in that position was to allow him to run interference on behalf of the CIA. And again, that's my opinion, but it's not exactly the most wild speculation you've ever heard, I'm sure.
Not at all. Not at all. It's in the absence of any explanation from the CIA, it's a perfectly reasonable conclusion to reach. And recognize that we've never had an explanation of Ioannidis' role in these events from the CIA. And, you know, the CIA talks to reporters all the time in Washington. You know, if they want to fill you in on what they think happened and what, you know, what they think the public needs to know, they you know, they take us aside and they let us know. You know, that's the way that's reporters work with the CIA. So if the CIA wanted to clarify this issue, you know, they have my number. They have my request for more information. They just won't provide it. And that's telling too, right? Because if there's a good innocent explanation, just give it, you know, why not?
There you go. If in, you know, if an innocent party can lose nothing by explaining their position, then there is absolutely no reasonable explanation for why they wouldn't provide it. So where does that lead us? Well, you can conclude for yourself. But to my opinion, again, that leads us into some very dark territory. And at the very least, as I said, whether it is, you know, the failure to act of that agency, or it is the complicity in some way, shape, or form, or it is the active conspiratorial action, it's irrelevant. Because the fact is that if it were nothing but an innocuous position that the agency had in these events, there would be absolutely no reason for revealing it, especially now. Because, you know, the argument is often made that you could endanger operations or operatives. Well, how do you endanger dead operatives and 50-year-old operations? This is... what does it tell you? Well, I don't think I need to explain it. I think that anyone with a little bit of common sense, and I'm hoping that most of the people listening to me have some, you guys can figure that one out for yourself. Is there anything you wanted to add?
No, I think we've covered everything, Chuck. It's been a very good conversation, so thank you.
Listen, I really appreciate you coming on with me tonight, and I'll be more than happy to do this again. You know, and please let me know how it is that they decide to react to paying back your costs, because...
Yes, I will keep you posted on that, and please send me the podcast version of this, and I will post it on JFK Facts as well.
Oh, no problem. I'll you know what I do is it automatically posts to the Ocelli Effect page, like minutes after I'm done. It shows up there. But later on tonight, I'll send you the RSS link and the well, let's see. Could I just send you the file? Do you want the MP3 file, or do you want just?
Yeah, that would be good too. I can actually put that on the site.
All right, then I'll make sure to send that to you, and we'll hopefully speak again, okay?
Very good, Chuck. Thanks a million.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Morton.
Take care.
Take care now. So listen, if you guys want to call in and talk about any of this stuff that I just covered, you know, please feel free to. Turn my head away, sorry. Which is, you know, you guys should know the UCY TV number, which is 718-717-8296. You know, give me a call if you want. If you want to hear anything about my thoughts on this situation, you can check out Jefferson Morley. He is, you know, one of the few guys, like I said, in the mainstream who has done some legitimate work here. And I think the significance of what he is covering is so extremely important. And meanwhile, this is a guy who is not trying to be one of these conspiracy theorists who is just wildly speculating about the agency's involvement. He's following the evidence, okay? And it's not necessarily, you know, a matter of, you know, leaping from one conclusion to another and not being able to draw a very solid line. He is being very responsible about the way he's doing it. And I think that this is an important thing to spotlight. And the reason somebody asked me earlier today why it is that I was bringing on Morley as far as the, you know, JFK thing goes, because he really is not extremely focused on the Kennedy assassination per se, as far as most of his writing goes. I mean, obviously the JFKfacts.org website is, but he is really an example of solid journalism being done that doesn't give you a conspiracy theory at all. It gives you the reality of what is actually, in fact, a conspiracy, not a theory. Okay? And he does that without attempting to reach that conclusion. So often people put the conclusion long before the evidence, okay? And so I thought it was important. Not only that, but the other significance behind my bringing him on was that I had sat here for 2 hours with Joan Mellon on my first show, and we went over the entire Jim Garrison, you know, connection to the assassination. We discussed Jim Garrison for 2 hours. We discussed many other things, but the focus was Jim Garrison. Jim Garrison was the subject of the Oliver Stone movie. If you haven't seen it, you really should. Even though it is theatrical and it does contain, you know, not mistakes, but sort of a little bit of license in that, dramatic license in that, you know, in some cases, characters are combined to represent more than one person, but you have a singular individual so that, you know, a multi-layered story can be told and stuff like this. And the Mr. X character is not entirely fictional, but he's based on correspondence as opposed to a face-to-face meeting. Stuff like this is done in that movie. But that movie is based on the trial that Jim Garrison tried to bring regarding the Kennedy assassination. Jim Garrison was the district attorney of New Orleans. Okay, so now we see the New Orleans connection to the J.M. Wade connection. Oswald is in New Orleans. All that stuff goes down as far as the Joannides situation. You know, Joannides was in a perfect place for the agency to know what was going on, and the U.S. government doesn't want to reveal to anybody what Joannides was really doing. So Jefferson Morley, with the help of Jim Lazar, files Freedom of Information Act lawsuits. They have won and received some of those files now. Okay, but it's an ongoing thing. Okay, so meanwhile, we also have the situation where we talk about what Jefferson Morley wrote about in his book, which was Our Man in Mexico, and that was about Wynn Scott. Well, Wynn Scott, again, was the station chief in Mexico City, and Oswald had supposedly been observed by the CIA in Mexico City. So, again, we have another assassination connection. Not only that, but Wynn Scott is directly connected to and the immediate supervisor of David Attlee Phillips. Now, for those of you who don't know that name, you should know it. This guy is a player, let's just say, in the counterintelligence business in that time. Now, David Attlee Phillips leads us to other people, okay? And Wynn Scott leads us to other people. Like, who else participated in some of this stuff? Guys like E. Howard Hunt. All of this stuff is linked, okay? And you can take it from the Kennedy assassination to now. And I know I'm fond of saying that JFK was the last true president we had in this country because he was the last guy to think for a minute that he was in charge. The rest of them since then, in my opinion again, and I do believe that we can prove this out if you look at the way things have gone, the last guy who thought he was in charge was JFK. The last two presidents to actually challenge the CIA and to sit there and try and rein them in were John F. Kennedy and, guess who, Richard Nixon. Well, you know what? The Nixon Watergate affair was, in my opinion, again, something that the agency was involved in because, after all, they had just assassinated the president in 63. Less than 10 years later, the American public, after having lived through all the assassinations in 68 and all of the other political and social upheaval that had occurred during that time period, it wouldn't have been tolerable to put another bullet in another president's head right away. So therefore, how do we get rid of Nixon, who's now challenging the CIA? Because, again, another fool thinks he's in charge. Well, if you want to read about that, believe me, there's places you can find out about it, but most of that material is still classified as well. But the Watergate affair is not necessarily the clear-cut case of a corrupt politician alone. Was Nixon corrupt? Sure he was. And I'm not going to sit here and defend him that he wasn't or that he had any sort of an angelic glow to him in any way, shape, or form. But the agency was involved on every single level of that operation as well. And if you think about it logically, as I said, there was no way to remove another president by gunplay. Because if you would have done it, it would have been just a little too obvious. And if you don't believe me about Nixon trying to challenge the CIA, I advise you to check into that a little bit more. And you can find out about the guy who was there at the head at the time, Richard Helms, who was an interesting character in and of himself, I assure you. But all of these things string from one to the next to the next. Of course, after Nixon's resignation and disgrace, who comes into the puppet president post but Gerald Ford? Well, where do we know Gerald Ford from besides he was a congressman from Michigan? Well, he was Warren Commissioner Gerald Ford, okay? And Warren Commissioner Gerald Ford ends up becoming president of the United States without ever having a vote cast for him for either vice or president, right? Nice. Doesn't that seem a little bit suspicious? Then we could go into the Carter administration. We could talk about another puppet administration that follows that, which is the Reagan administration. And, of course, we know about Mr. George H.W. Bush. And, again, I offhandedly refer to the Bush family as one of the most public crime syndicates you've ever seen. And I have my reasons for that. And if you want to argue with me about it, then we can discuss how they, you know, implemented all sorts of instruments of murder for individuals throughout the globe by participating in illegal warfare ad infinitum, okay? Still, These are my opinions drawn from historical research. Now, another fascinating little piece of history there is that George H.W. Bush, claiming that he had never had any sort of association to the CIA, becomes head of the CIA under President Gerald Ford. You know, it gets too easy to draw certain lines. Now, I know not everybody's in the mood for a history lesson, and that's why I wanted to make sure that I stressed to you guys that, without a doubt, all of these things lead up to what it is we are confronted by today. Okay? When you want to complain about the fact that Obama is, you know, the puppet he is, and you want to complain about W was also an interesting sort of puppet, and Cheney. Well, don't forget, by the way, Vice President Cheney, I believe his first appearance in the White House along with Rumsfeld was also during the Ford administration. I may be wrong, but, you know, it does occur to me that that's about when that happened. But that's not of any sort of significance, right? Notice how the same players keep popping up throughout this entire menagerie of puppet shows, okay? And it really comes down to who actually runs things, who actually has the power, who actually has the control. And so many people have so many theories, and they never look at this kind of stuff. I don't know. Maybe I'm all alone about this. But I hope that at least I've given you guys an indication of where you can start to look. You know, it's not as though we're looking at the guys who are really pulling the strings, but it is interesting to see what puppets they choose. Okay? And the Muppet Show keeps on. Anyway, I hope you guys did enjoy the whole thing with Jefferson Morley, and I know that I do have a little bit of a proclivity to bring up the JFK thing a lot. I spent a lot of years on it. So, you know, it led me into a lot of different directions, let's just say, and a lot of different investigations into a lot of different things. So I didn't just spend time studying Dealey Plaza and where bullets landed and exactly how Oswald's gun functioned, even if it was his gun, and the mail records of that, which are questionable, and how the post office disappeared their own, you know, their own forms, and how Oswald was set up, and all this other fun stuff, and who actually was Lee Harvey Oswald. Oh, I spent plenty of time on that. And I don't even consider myself an Oswald expert by any means. But you spend a few years on things, I guess you're more of an expert than others are. But what it does when you study a guy like Lee Harvey Oswald is give you a very good insight as to how these types of, well, he said it, patsies are created. And patsies nowadays, you know, get all kinds of terrible things pinned on them for convenience. And I think that is of great interest because, look, you can see in the very, you know, it's like the beta test versions of what later became, you know, the false flag operators that would occur later. And I think it's extremely revealing. Maybe it's just a dance into history, and maybe I'm just barking at the moon. But I'm going to keep barking. Now, when you take a look at the operations of the NSA, and we talk about the Snowden revelations, and we talk about how disinformation is created and the interaction of the press, this is also something that interests us. And one of the primary things that we can study in our contemporary modern historical era is the way the Kennedy assassination was handled. There is a media standpoint that came about that, you know, a sort of standard operating procedure that grew out of the events that occurred in 1963. The ability to disseminate the CIA's narratives and the ability to disseminate the NSA's narratives, you know, these things all really began to come to their modern form in that time period. This is how this crap that's being shoveled on us by the CNNs and the MSNBCs and the other outlets of all sorts came to be, okay? No matter what you saw, no matter what you heard, don't believe your lying eyes. Turn on the TV. We'll explain to you how to think. And, of course, that's evolved as well. Now, there's all kinds of discussions we can go into about the technology of the electronic media, about the structure of the information which is disseminated through the print media, which is nearly irrelevant at this point. But as we step further into what I call the alternative media, it is important to note the disasters of the past. And it's important to note how people are tricked. Do they tell us just straight up lies? Sometimes. Do they turn around and disseminate their crap alongside of provable facts? Of course they do. Because if some of their story is believable, then of course more of their story must be believable. And again, don't believe your lying eyes, because I've got a picture. It doesn't matter if I made it up or I manufactured it or I sort of cobbled it together from different elements. No, that's kind of not the relevant point here, is it? Here's the picture. Now you see it. Well, the reality is, now you don't. If you want the reality of what actually occurred in any given situation, whether it be the Kennedy assassination or the fire down the street, you're not going to get it from the alphabet-labeled, government-supported and dependent media. And that's the way it is. Now, among the alternative media, there are still plenty of disinformation agents. We know who they are. At least we think we do. You must show caution no matter who it is that's giving you what you think is the truth. Oftentimes, the honesty of the broadcaster in your mind has very little to do with how honest they truly are, but more to do with your own position and them feeding into that position that was preconceived. When that happens, we sort of gravitate towards certain things. That's the way that I was for a long time. I have since come out of that. We often call it waking up. I don't know if it's quite waking up so much as simply opening one's eyes. Because the reality is actually around you. And if you simply accept the construct that they present to you and decide in your own mind that that's reality, then that is what it'll be. Now, I know that sounds kind of like a strange backward statement, but it's true. And even in the alternative so-called, outside of the mainstream media, I've got to tell you, I'm learning more and more about the individuals who are not out for truth. They're not out for the real facts. They're not out to report to you anything that is not going to support an agenda. We all have agendas. I know that. I'm using it as a generic term. But some of those agendas, when you begin to examine what it is they're disseminating to you, have a great deal to do more with their agenda than the truth that you think you're getting. And I'm learning this bit by bit, and I hope everybody who can hear what I'm saying is doing the same thing. The JFK assassination is an important moment in history. I'm going to continue to do programs on it, but it's not going to be my only focus, I assure you. Okay? And What I will also do alongside of this is hopefully lay out the positions that I have taken on many other things with the help of others. Some of them guests, some of them callers, whatever, over time. And perhaps we'll get a whole lot closer to truth, you know, than some of these other people in the media. I don't know. But I'm going to do my best. And hopefully, with all of your help, we'll sort all this crap out. So, I know I'm running low on time, and I know I've sat here and just talked a little philosophical sort of self-indulgence for a bit, but I thought it was necessary. I also want to say that, you know, and I know that I say this a lot, but I want to make sure it gets heard that I really appreciate Jules and everybody who has been so kind to me at UCY.TV. This has really been an experience, and I'm starting to get a feel for what it is I'm going to do here. My idea of what I started to do and what it is, the direction I'm taking now, is starting to change a bit. But I think that it's going to be a lot of it's going to be fun for me in a way, but it's also going to be very valuable. And I think it's going to be very worthwhile for myself and anybody who decides to, you know, click on UCY while I'm talking anyway. And I really want to make an effort to push what it is that I'm giving to you guys to a higher level than what you're used to. And on those lines, I really want to apologize for that mess that went on Worldwide Live this week, because I really did not exert the amount of control that I should have, and that was a very sloppy broadcast. So I apologize to anybody who sat through that and didn't get the benefit of a more professional presentation that should have been had. And regardless of what it is that we're discussing on these airwaves, I really hope that everybody who is part of this network takes the time to give it a very serious, professional sort of feel, because, you know, if we're giving you good information, then it deserves to be presented in a coherent manner that that can be consumed by all and understood by the thinking public that wants to hear us. And I think that that's part of our responsibility to ourselves and to Jules, who gave us this platform and has given us the chance to speak our minds, to make our presentations, and to literally broadcast our ideas as far as those ideas will carry themselves. And I can't thank Jules enough for her help in doing that. And I really appreciate all you guys in the chat. I know I haven't actually read anything out of the chat tonight or anything, but I have it on. And, you know, you guys are what makes this happen. And I really appreciate all of you. And, you know, I want you to know that I feel a responsibility to you guys as well, that I want to make sure that every time I come to the microphone on this network, I give you something of value. And that is really what I want to be about on here. And I know I didn't take a great deal of time to explain myself earlier on in some of my broadcasts, because honestly, 2 hours was taken up really quickly with some other things, and I got off on other tangents, but I wanted to take this time to do that, because I was thinking about it earlier today, and I really hope that you guys do find it valuable. And I'll tell you what, if you don't, do me a favor and let me know that too, because I want to improve, and I'm quite willing to take any sort of criticisms you guys have. I've only taken a couple of email criticisms, and it's funny because it was from people that got downloads later of the podcast. You know, not the live listeners, but, you know, either way, I'm willing to accept all the criticisms that come in, and I want to improve. So I'm not generally a professional broadcaster of any kind. I'm not generally a professional public speaker. I was usually a musician and somebody who was a supporting writer, a supporting, you know, fact finder and gatherer of useful facets of different presentations for other people. That's what I've always done. And I've been a guest on other shows and stuff like that over time. And this is really a different sort of thing when it's your deal and you have to present it and you have to fill that time. And you have to fill that time not just with the ramblings of your own mind all the time, but useful, interesting, and solid information. So I just want you guys to know that there is going to be a standard about whatever it is I participate in from now on. And I've made a few mistakes thus far, and I hope you guys will bear with me as I learn. But either way, I appreciate it all, and again, you know, you guys can contact me at any time. My personal email for you guys is Chuck, C-H-U-C-K, 1972, at L-Y-C-O-S, that's Lycos.com. You guys can email me information, show ideas, whatever you want. I will try to read every single thing, and I will take everything serious that's sent to me seriously. Okay? I'm not very good at reading in the chat room. I see you guys, though. And see some smiley faces right now. Oh, thanks. Anyways, I'm not very good at doing that, but believe me, all of your feedback will be appreciated. The fact that you guys have given me even a moment to listen to what I have to say, again, is appreciated. And also, you know, the guys who have been really nice and friendly to me on the network, I want to say thanks to them as well, because I got some discouraging things that occurred to me this week. And really honestly, without the support of some of the other people on here, like Jim Funky, like JJ Inc., and even the nice words from Vince and everything, you know, and Jules herself, if it wasn't for the encouragement of those people, I think I might have actually given up this week. You know, because even though I love to run my mouth, I don't want to do it unless I'm going to make a difference in some way, shape, or form. So all those people in one way or another made me feel as though I was contributing something here, and I hope that I am, and I intend to improve it, to sharpen it, to make it better. So hopefully all of us together on this network can do something really, really unique, really special, and who knows, maybe even knock out some of those bigger dogs in that alternative stream. Because I'm real tired of the nonsense from some of the so-called alternative media. And I'm not going to get into specifics right now, but I think we all know what I'm talking about. Anyhow, I'm just about done, and I'm no longer in the state of New Jersey. I'm in North Carolina now, and so you might hear my accent shift around a little bit. By all means, you know, if you guys got, you know, a couple of bucks or whatever, donate to the UCY donation button, which, you know, I know you guys see it now and then. You know, throw Jules a couple of bucks, because I really want to make sure that this thing keeps going. And like I said, you know, if there's anything that you guys think needs to be covered, if there's stuff you want to hear about, if I don't know about it, I'll find out about it, or I'll find somebody who can do it for me. One way or another, I want to make this a learning experience. you know, not just for you guys, but for myself. So, you know, I am open to all that. So, you know what? I also put up the feed on, I put up the feed on the Ocelli Effect Facebook page. By the way, I do have an Ocelli Effect Facebook page. I always forget to mention that. I have a .com that I'm working on, the OcelliEffect.com, but it's not done. So I'm doing that stuff slowly on my own, which is not easy. But if you go to the Facebook page and you know, like it or whatever, there's a link there for, there's a bunch of links for UCY all the time, different shows and stuff. I've also posted some of the other shows on my SoundCloud that that I did on here and elsewhere. I also posted some of the shows I participated in on UCY in case they end up, you know, scrolling off, because I think the UCY page only holds 10. Of course, I think this is my fourth show, so, you know, if you guys are interested, you can go get that. And, you know, just keep in mind that the more that we spread the better information, the better off all of us are. So I know I've only got about 5 minutes left or something like that, probably less. And, you know, I just feel really hopeful for this project, and I feel really hopeful for the network in general. And I really want you guys to stay tuned, and we're gonna get out of this little rut of having, you know, tons of Cooper and May Brussel, and I don't know if Tarpley's gonna go, but you know, my gut says that he's not exactly what we need to keep here either. I really hope that we can develop tons more original programming, and really enjoy, of course, I enjoy Jim's show, Boiler Room, which is on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I don't catch every episode, but I do download them, so I catch them off and on. You can get any of the shows post immediately, just about after the show, to the show's page as a downloadable MP3. I know most of you guys know this, but from there, there's also the YouTube channel, which I don't know how many people are going to that, but most of the shows go right up on there as well. And, you know, spread it around. If nothing else, spread it around. If you think that this stuff that we're talking about, all the issues we're covering, and all the shows are important or interesting or valuable to you, then since they're being given away to you, why not give them away to others? That's just my opinion again, but that's how I see it. Anyway, so, as I've said many a time, I hope you guys enjoyed this. And this is a lot of fun for me. Anyhow, nobody called in. That's okay, too. By the way, if anybody runs into Justin, tell him I am going to take him up on that little thing that he mentioned to me. So we'll see what happens there, because I know a lot of people want to see him come back. And also, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to put together some new stuff in the coming weeks. So, just about 2 minutes left, and I always take a minute to look at things because my eyesight sucks so bad. I'll probably look back over the chat room when I'm done, after I take a little breather, and then we're going to have After the Last Cup is coming up in just a few minutes here with, I think Jim Funky's still doing that, so After the Last Cup will be on right after this, and then you know how it goes after that. The replays happen. But wouldn't it be nice if we could start replaying our own stuff? If we built up such a library of archives that, you know, we wouldn't require all these Bill Coopers and stuff, which one of these days I'll probably get around to doing a show on Bill Cooper, because I've got a few interesting insights into that, or at least stuff that I think is interesting. You know, because I received one of those VHS tapes in the late 80s. I think I told somebody this week. I can't remember who or if I said it on the air because sometimes I forget who I actually said what to anymore because I'm talking so much. But, yeah, there's a lot to be said there, too. And that's it. You guys enjoy. Have a good night. And I'll catch you after the last cup next. Nothing chilly, no chilly effect. Bye.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was there.
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
In the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
all these
books,
and how can that be possible for him? You know,
or the
rest of the 80s.